This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Good afternoon, everybody. Hopefully you can hear me okay. And it's good to start the afternoon session because clearly everybody's been fed and watered and you're all looking quite relaxed and ready and raring to go. One of the things I thought would just be helpful from a personal perspective is if people could just indicate by showing their hands, and if you're watching online or you're doing this at home or listening on the web, then feel free to join in, please. But if you can raise your hand if you feel over the last 6 months you've had a personal contribution to end of life and actually improved the service in some way over the last 6 months. Can you raise your hand? Excellent. So hold your hands there. Don't put them down. Now, I won't go through the whole talk holding your hands up, honest, just to keep you awake. But now what I want to ask is, okay, so put your hands up, those that have had their hands up. That's it. So are you convinced that your personal contribution, because that's fantastic, for those that can't see it, it's almost 100% here. Are you convinced that actually that's been embedded into a process, system or way of working that were you not involved in the future, it would still happen in a positive way? Ah, okay. So a few hands stayed up. Thank you. For that, and a number of hands went down, and I think that's quite a fitting way of starting what I want to say and moving on later to what Julia wants to say to you, because I think one of the things that we're very mindful of is that although there are some very good, excellent pockets of good practice, there are also some things that actually we haven't quite embedded. So we've had some really good ideas, we've had some good ways of working, but we haven't quite embedded them into the process. One of the other things that I was pleased about when I walked in the room was I thought I was well coordinated today. Do people agree? My tie matches the... It's all part of the plan. And actually, that's a surprise for me because usually I'm speaking here from an adult social care point of view with very recognisable blue NHS insignia. So I'm delighted, actually, and this is a serious point, to be in this room today with so many partners being displayed on this board. Because I think that's part of the challenge that we have around end-of-life care as we go forward, that it is about everybody's business and it is about engaging with partners fully. And I think, nobody's fault, but I do think that a lot of this has been branded around the NHS. And that's been quite a challenge, certainly for me, as a Director of Adult Social Services in London, as I'm sure it has been across the country. So in terms of the content, I'm going to go through quite quickly the first few slides around some of the key messages from back in July 2010, some of those challenges of the implementation of the framework, some progress that's been made, some examples of some of that, and some challenges for social care and partnerships generally. And then I want to end with just a bit of a personal experience that will feed nicely into what Dr. Riley will come and talk to you about in terms of the work that we've been doing. So first of all, just to state the obvious, and again, I'm going to skip through these quite quickly, social care has a vital role to play in supporting people to live and to die well in the place of their choice, because actually, if we don't work with people positively and in a coordinated way with our partners, then we'll have a real problem on our hands. And I do believe that some areas are doing that very well indeed. The other thing is the social care workforce may not be employed by the council totally these days, but we have a responsibility in terms of training, in terms of opportunities, and the way in which social care workers and social workers generally are supported. And we have to recognise that there's a need for skills and training around that area. Now, many people that have been in the social care world, and I actually talk about children's world and adults' world because I've been in both, and I'm pleased to say I'm currently in adults' world, just in case you didn't get that from my presentation. And actually, in adults' world, it's quite helpful to be able to have conversations with people and to talk to them about how actually it's like to be a child, and in some cases where either they may have a terminal illness or, in fact, they may have parents who die when they're young as well. So one of the positive things for me is about how the transformation of adult social care must take on board the whole spectrum from transition from children into adulthood as well. But it is fair to say that we have a major transformation going on in adult social care, which means that we put the person absolutely squarely at the centre of our decision making. And that's been underpinned by significant changes in our social work education and training. And I have to say, not everybody's got it yet. And I have to say that the support systems, generally in local government, haven't quite got there. So most of our challenges actually come from support services like finance, like audit, like HR. So they are a challenge that, although we want to move forward with transformation of adult social care, sometimes they take some difficult times to get through because people don't want to take some of the risks. The word that was forgot this morning was reablement. Clearly, people who are discharged from hospital these days, we're very keen to make sure that we put through a reablement process. And absolutely, I think almost every local authority has accepted, in conjunction with the local NHS, that actually reablement is free for the first 6 weeks at least. And that follows on from what was and continues to be intermediate care as well. But it's also important that commissioners of services, whether NHS or whether the local authority, they have to understand the importance of using reablement positively for people. And actually, some of that reablement we've experienced is really important for people who may be going home to die, because actually a lot of people get disadvantaged when in hospital, and actually they've still got some skills that they need to develop and to use even at the end of life. And so we're being quite open and positive about that. And I think the whole offer that social care has, and if our colleagues in the room from hospices will know, that where you've got specialist social work, palliative care social workers, they bring a lot to the table. And I think it's a challenge for those social workers to share with their colleagues who are doing day-to-day work that's less exposed to end of life to help them to move that on. Greater integration, absolutely key, and it's a big challenge, and it's not more so now than it's ever been. I believe that I come from a borough that's pretty in tune with the health commissioners and with the GP consortia. Thank goodness we've only got one, so that's really helpful. So we're working on the same page. But actually, it is about working through those challenges that integration brings in a positive way to enhance the way in which we provide services for end of life. And the other good thing about it is that we need to start thinking about documenting this work. And it was good this morning to see where people have begun to document the differences that it makes. Because until we do, we won't be able to persuade people that it's the right way forward to work in an integrated way together. Because everyone will be worried about how much it's going to cost them. And that's the last thing, to be honest, that's on my mind. So the key points really is strategic commissioning is vital. We've heard some of that good practice this morning. The care planning, enabling people, the professionals to talk to individuals about what end of life can really mean. The fact that it's actually a coordinated care is important. The notion that we need some rapid response services, and I have to say Redbridge isn't quite there yet in terms of the rapid response, but we're doing some work together with our colleagues in other services within the council and the NHS to do something about that. But it's vital that when we do want to offer quality services, we have a 24/7 approach and it's still patchy. Quality is key. Actually, it's not about frequency. It's not about how many visits you get. It's not about actually what we want to achieve by an end date. It's about the quality of the care and that it actually is fit for purpose and is the choice of the individual. We need to make sure we use an integrated care pathway. We need to talk to each other, whether that's from a partner outside of the NHS or whether it's from the NHS and social care together. And the partnership has to work to support carers. Now, again, there's lots of debate around carers and the finances and the resources that are available. Redbridge is very clear, the politicians are very clear, that actually we couldn't do our business if we didn't have the vast support from the carers within the community that we do have that are unpaid. And the family members are key alongside the professional carers to achieve positive outcomes. And then it has to be embedded within education, training, the workforce. I did an email round to my London director colleagues and said, tell me something that is positive that's happened as a result of implementing the social care framework. And by the way, do you actually know it exists? Now, that's a bit of a silly thing, you might think, for me to ask directors of adult social services. But actually, I do think we need to do more to promote the importance of the things that I've just described to you, because actually not everybody in social care, if you went out today, would go up to them and say, do you know and how are you implementing the framework, would know what you were talking about. So I think that's not through a want of trying, but I do think people need to be encouraged to understand it more. One of those responses was from Hounslow, and one of the things that struck me, and why I included it in the slide, was it's not rocket science, but actually they've done what we experienced earlier in Devon has done, which is to have a very clear joint commissioning strategy for adults, and they've took on board those bullet points that are there. We can't provide services unless we are ensured that people's dignity is protected. We need to make sure that we engage with carers. We need to make sure that we listen and we learn from the experiences and so on. So there's a whole series of bullet points of things that's happening in Hounslow. You'd be surprised if I didn't put something on here about Redbridge. We've had some really good work done for dementia end of life for some time now, where we've got a particular project, and we've also got close working relationship with the partners that are there. Partly that's been driven by my personal passion, which I'll tell you about in a moment, but actually it's also important when it comes to the way in which we deliver services to people with dementia and how we think ahead in time to make a difference. One thing that I don't think we've mentioned yet today is the importance of the local politicians. We've talked about national strategy, we've talked about the government, etc. But actually, one of the things I was keen to do was to encourage the local politicians to have a scrutiny working group around this work. And actually, that wasn't comfortable, I have to say. Local politicians calling in people from the health service, calling in partners from the hospice, calling in partners from provider services was a challenge. But actually, I think the outcome was really positive. And there's a report, the link is there in the slides, that I would encourage you to go and look at. One of the key things about that was that we set up a task and finish group that's now joined up with the NHS, because we were both going to run separate groups around end of life. How stupid is that? But now we've recognised through this work that actually it's important to do that together. And just to say as well, in terms of fast track and enabling people to go out of hospital, we've got some very excellent working relationships now locally with our health partners. So I then got asked as part of the London ADAS, and in case you haven't noticed, it's here. And here. Just in case, sorry. But ADAS in London recognised they had no one that was responsible for or in tune with what was happening in terms of end of life, and they asked me then to lead on that. And very quickly, I got the opportunity to meet with Dr. Riley, who had done some really tremendous work, I think, around Coordinate My Care, and she'll tell you more about that in a moment. But one of the things that we acknowledged and recognised was there was no social care input to it. So we actually met a small group of us to try and ensure that we could change that to incorporate social care. And because there's already existing pilots, Sutton, Merton and Croydon are going to be working from a social care perspective in terms of Coordinate My Care. And as I say, you'll hear more about that shortly. So the challenges, I think there are specific local resources that organisations around the national strategy that actually we should have had and could have had but just simply aren't available. So resources is always going to be an issue, but it doesn't stop you from actually making a difference and doing things locally. We still need to work better, I think, with care home providers, although, again, you will talk to individuals who say they've got good working relationships, good provider forums, good access and linking up. But I just think across the country it's quite patchy. But in London, certainly, there's been some improvements around that. The GP support in the home to those care homes, but also to key decision makers within social care is key as well. And I think that's something we're beginning to work on, but it still needs more work. And I think there's a potential that we could end up with less people undertaking assessment of need. And I agree absolutely with what was said this morning. It's about the assessment of need. And we need to get that assessment right, and we need to understand how we can help people move forward. The other thing is that there's been a real big cut, particularly in the NHS, around strategic leadership. And I don't think we can just ignore that. 50% of my colleagues who I worked with on a day-to-day basis just disappeared 1 week in the NHS. And I think that is incredibly difficult for the rest of people that are left behind to manage that. But actually, it's a message for us too, that we have to work harder at making sure we speak to the right person. And we have to make sure that we can communicate. The last point there about N3, anyone that's got N3 connection will know how difficult it is to actually facilitate N3 connection in social care, because it's very much a local authority asking to join an NHS system. Now, very, very quickly, because I know time's flying and I want Dr. Riley to come and actually reflect on this. This is George. George's my dad, and somebody who I've learnt so much about as a result of his end of life. Now, I would say, wouldn't I, that my dad was a great husband, a great father, a great brother, and he was. He was somebody who worked hard all his life, did well by his family, and supported us. George supported his wife too, Ethel, and in 2000, and the timescales are really interesting here when you think about the strategy and thinking that we've heard about earlier. In 2000, Ethel had breast cancer, and George became Ethel's main carer. Now, he supported her fully throughout that period of time until actually she died in June 2003. And actually, she died on George's birthday, which I thought was quite interesting, because it was only shortly after that that we took George home with us and suddenly realised that things weren't quite right. That actually, between him and Mum, they'd actually supported each other for 3 years, and they'd masked pretty well the fact that George was at the early onset dementia. So here we were with a situation in that week where we began to think, well, hang on, is this grief? Is this bereavement? Is this... And then we suddenly realised, actually, that there were things that weren't quite right. So, actually, George went back to his bungalow after the funeral in the hope that he would live independently. We went to the GP and spoke to the GP, and the GP said, well, hang on a minute, haven't you applied for George to move to Redbridge, because he lived in Southend? So he said, yes. So he said, well, I'm not making a referral to our memory clinic then. You'll have to wait till he gets to Redbridge. He ended up in Redbridge 3 months later, and a lot of hard work supporting him in the community. One of the good things about Ethel, knowing she was dying, was that we did do the preparation. So we did think about the fact that actually George would move into sheltered housing near us. So that was a good thing. And actually Ethel died at home, which again was another positive thing. But very quickly, when we got into Redbridge, George realised, and we realised, that he wasn't going to cope just in sheltered. And the GP was superb. She referred to the memory clinic. We engaged the right professionals. And we started to work with George in a positive way. He was so fit, he would go for walks that you wouldn't believe. But at 3 o'clock in the morning, not the best thing to do. So actually, what happened in the end was George moved into extra care, sheltered housing, and absolutely had a fantastic 3.5 years of his end of life, really. Except that we hadn't done all of the writing down of the wishes, the feelings, the desires. We'd done all the business. That was all sorted. I was the power of attorney and did all of that. But we didn't write down that crucial information. And actually, one day, George had had enough. He put himself to bed. He was going to die. And the carers were a little bit concerned, so they run the GP. The GP wasn't our GP, wasn't his GP. It was a locum, who then immediately called for the ambulance service. Immediately they arrived and they took George off to hospital. Now, at that point, I wasn't the director of adult social services, but I was the chief community care officer. So I thought, well, that's okay. I'll go down to the hospital, talk to my colleagues and get Dad back home again. Wasn't quite as easy as that, because George got pulled into the system. So for 13 days, I discussed and argued and challenged the senior medical staff within the hospital about why George was there. They didn't know what extra care was. They didn't know that he had a care team that could look after him. They didn't realise and recognise that actually he put himself to bed, because that's what his plan was, to die at home. Eventually, George was discharged, and I'm pleased to say there's a good end to the story, because George died at home, but he died at home 2 months later with full nursing care, with the cost of that to the state. He was a self-funder. He was previously paying his own care. And so for George, not only was it a traumatic experience that he didn't need, actually, he ended up costing the state a huge amount of money. So actually, for us, that was a positive end to a very difficult scenario, but it certainly taught us a whole range of different lessons. And actually, George, as I said, had a fantastic 3.5 years at Oakfield, and you'll see if people recognise Helen Shapiro popped in to say hello at the bottom, for those that remember Helen Shapiro, of course. So, actually, George had a great time. But what made a difference for George? Well, actually, confidence in the staff and the family. He actually trusted me. He wanted to be independent and take risks. Hence, he went on walkabout at very interesting hours of the day. Prepared to challenge the stereotype of the residential nursing by staying in extra care. His confidence, actually, in managing the situations was something that he knew he wanted to die at home. I forgot to say, really, but George was a lecturer, he was a teacher. So, actually, he wanted to help others learn, and that's what his whole purpose was. And creative solutions, assisted technology, and trust. Trust was the big thing. What made a difference for me? Well, all of those things that are on the slide. But importantly, knowing that actually, somehow, I managed to get Dad home, despite the odds. And I have to say despite the odds, because he could have been one of that 70% who would have died in hospital. Now, it's not all doom and gloom, and I'm going to hand over to Dr. Riley now to talk to you about, well, so why would it be different now if Coordinate My Care was involved?
Thank you, John, and thank you for inviting me to speak today. Coordinate My Care, we have a session after this, so I won't go into the details, but what I'm going to do is just take you through George's story, but what Coordinate My Care is, and George's story, and how we hope that George would not have gone through what he did go through. So what is Coordinate My Care? It's a clinical service that coordinates care. It does what it says on the tin, and it gives patients choice when they're able to make the choice, and it gives them an improved quality of life. And I say an improved quality of life because it's while they're living that they want the improved quality. It was born out of the end-of-life locality registers, and as we all know, nothing about me without me. This service, this clinical service, is absolutely nothing about me without me, because no patient or person goes onto this register, call it what you will, we call ours in London Coordinate My Care, unless they have consented to go on. Or, in best interests, their GP or healthcare provider believes they should go on it. So it's essentially putting the patient at the middle and deciding what that patient wants. So this is what it looks like. It is a service which wraps around the patient all the patient needs. So the GP, NHS 111, which I'll come to, out-of-hours GPs, London Ambulance Service, you'll be pleased, Steve Bonnard, to know that the London Ambulance Service was critical in developing Coordinate My Care, community nursing, hospital, hospices, home, care homes, and social care. And a lot have been mentioned today about health care and end-of-life care dying, but the more I work in communities, the more I realise that actually social care, people gently die at home. Like George, do they need a massive healthcare intervention? Perhaps they don't. So we want to put health and social care all together under Coordinate My Care. So this is what it looks like in terms of an IT infrastructure. We're currently working on, it is up and running, and we're out to tender at the moment for the definitive service. And the service will look like this. It's an IT infrastructure which links GPs, social services, community services. In London, our community IT services, BT. Rio, GP systems, logistics I've put in red because the iteration from not the next one but the following one, we will be including equipment. So if a patient goes home or needs something, the equipment will be delivered to their house. When they die, their equipment will be retrieved and an email will be alerted to the logistics supplier to do that. Links to acute hospitals and hospice systems. I've got a red arrow around the London Ambulance because it will be interoperable with the London Ambulance Service, but post the Olympics. So it goes live in this format in April next year, but the ambulance service will still be an email link rather than a direct interoperability. And the last tube is that of the integration of all the patients that go into the service, reports can be written. How many patients went into the service, what their wishes were, how they died, where they died, why there was a variance. And reports can be written for the Department of Health, with the Information Standards Board, NHS London, the commissioners and the providers. So how, you say, would this have helped George? Well, there's another service we are working with, and if you haven't heard about 111, 111 is the new unscheduled service which Lansley agreed to roll out in pilot form across England, and it's now been taken on by Cameron, so it clearly will be rolled out. In London, we are the preferred providers for the end-of-life care with 111. So what happens in 111? If instead of calling 999, you can call 111 for all services that are not the emergency services. They may be unscheduled. You then get taken down a triage pathway, and your London director of service will know, the 111 will know where the call's coming in from. So if it comes in from Hillingdon, they'll know to put it through to the Hillingdon 111 service to triage the calls. There's then a directory of services for Hillingdon, and everything in Hillingdon is in the 111 directory of services that they call the DOS. And then there's Coordinate My Care, which underpins all the services for the end-of-life care patients, and the Coordinate My Care is the same for everyone in London, whereas the individual services offer wherever the service is. For London, the end-of-life care programme is one. So what happens? The call comes in, the public caller, and it might be the carer, it might be the patient. Immediately that address is flagged up at 111, and it flags up to say this patient is on Coordinate My Care, or someone at that address has Coordinate My Care. The call handler will then identify if the patient is the patient on Coordinate My Care, or if the caller is calling about the CMC patient. If this is a CMC patient, the call handler no longer takes the call. It is directed straight to CMC. And the CMC is your end-of-life care plan and everything you want on it, and it's taken by the clinical person at the service desk. So the 111 has care advisors, which take all the first calls, and then it's triaged straight to the clinician if the patient is on Coordinate My Care. The clinician then makes three issues: either excruciating uncontrolled pain, massive bleeding, or intolerable breathlessness. And if those are crises that the caller is calling about, an ambulance will be dispatched immediately. Within 4 to 10 minutes, the ambulance will be there, because that patient or carer is in extremis, and even if in the best made plans, they need help, and they need help quickly. So an ambulance will be dispatched. Otherwise, the clinician goes through the symptom that pertains to Coordinate My Care, and if it is on the care plan, the clinician will do what is specified in that care plan. And I'll come to what is specified in a social care plan. If it is not in the care plan, if we have a patient with cancer of the prostate who's gently dying, expected to get bone pain, but suddenly has crushing left-sided chest pain, and left-sided chest pain was not in the care plan, then the clinician automatically does what normally happens with 111, and again they go down the red line and a 999 ambulance is dispatched. If the patient's bashed their toe or there's something less urgent, instead of handing the call back to the call handler, the call will be handed down and the clinician will take them through the ordinary NHS pathways, and the disposition will be according to that directory of services. So Coordinate My Care will be completely integrated into 111 service for London. So George's story. We hope that working with social services and developing our pilot in Merton, Sutton and Croydon, that we start to get care plans developed not only by healthcare professionals, but by social care professionals. They're perfectly capable of knowing when patients are deteriorating. And so if we look at George's case, in 2003, George's main carer, his wife, as you've heard, died. George moves in with John. John realises there's a problem. He's failing to cope. The minute somebody's failing to cope and beginning to deteriorate, someone like John, had coordinate my cab in there, might have said, what about let's getting him a care plan? A year later, he goes to the memory clinic. Well, the memory clinic is a number of places where Alzheimer's patients are diagnosed and people who need added care. People who are chronically in chronic care pathways coming to the end of their lives. Another place where this should have been flagged up. In 2004, he needs extra care. He's referred to social services, and in his sheltered housing, he needs extra care. If the social services, and we will develop the care plans for social services, which will go on to coordinate my care as a separate tab. Again, extra care, does that not alert one to the fact that something this patient might need a record? George's wishes. It's very interesting to hear John say, George knew his wishes. He wanted to die at home. The family knew his wishes, but because there wasn't a document, when the locum GP came out, there was nothing to stop the locum GP doing what locum GPs do. And take a medical history, it's a problem, send him into hospital. When he puts himself to bed in 2008, so you see, at many places during George's journey, it could have been identified, and we hope in the future it will be identified, that George is deteriorating, George needs help, George needs documentation of what help and what his wishes are, whilst his memory is good enough and he has capacity to make those choices. When he's discharged with the continuing care, the DS-1500 is filled out. That's a key position where all health and social services should know. If your DS-1500 is being filled out, we really should be looking at should a coordinate my care record be made. On the emergency services in the 111, there will be emergency duty team. Now, there's an emergency duty team, I'm told, in all social services, where they come on. As the day staff go on, there are a couple of minutes of overlap, and then the emergency duty team do what we call, or out of hours, what they call emergency duty team. And so the emergency duty team could have actually come in to help George, and it would have been on his care record to enable him to die at home. So when I first spoke to John, he said George did not want a slow death. He did not want to be a burden to the state. He did not want to tie up resources, beds, equipment and nurses. But he did want to die at home with the carers he knew. He got his wish, his final wish, but at a cost to himself, his carers, his family and the state. All because there was no written end-of-life care plan. My message to you is as we roll out Coordinate My Care for London, I hope George's history is something of the past. Thank you.